At the outbreak of the First World War, cryptography was in disarray. The science of secret communication was struggling because all known codes and ciphers were vulnerable to attack, and so the search was on for a new, stronger type of encryption. The situation was particularly desperate because of the advent of radio. Wireless communication was a boon to the military because radio waves emanate in all directions and can reach almost anywhere. That meant that a general could communicate with his battalions no matter where they were. However, the all-pervasive nature of radio is also its greatest weakness, because it is inevitable that messages will also reach the enemy. If the enemy could intercept every single radio message, then cryptographers had to find a way of preventing them from deciphering these messages. Between 1914 and 1918, there were to be no great discoveries, merely a catalogue of cryptographic failures. Code makers conjured up several new ciphers, but in each case, it was merely a matter of time before it was cracked by the code breakers. In particular, the Allied code breakers consistently broke German ciphers, and their influence on the First World War is best illustrated by the decipherment of a German telegram that was intercepted by the British on the 17th of January 1917. Just a week earlier, on the 9th of January 1917, the German Supreme High Command held a momentous meeting. Previously, the Germans had agreed that U-boats must surface before firing their torpedoes, a restriction that would limit accidental attacks on civilian shipping. But now, German commanders were agreed on a course of all-out U-boat aggression. Although such a change of policy would cut off supply lines and starve Britain into submission within 6 months, the Germans were fearful that their plan might backfire. Up until this point, President Woodrow Wilson had kept America neutral, but the inevitability of civilian casualties threatened to draw America into the war. So the German foreign minister, Arthur Zimmermann, decided to draw up an insurance policy. Zimmermann sent a telegram to the president of Mexico, stating that in the case of America entering the war, then Germany would support a Mexican invasion of America, helping it to reclaim territories such as Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. If Zimmermann's plan worked, then America would be too busy defending itself at home to become involved in the European conflict. Zimmermann knew that the British were tapping the transatlantic cable, and so he took the precaution of encrypting the telegram before sending it to Mexico. However, he underestimated the skills of the British codebreakers, who immediately set to work deciphering the telegram. The Admiralty's codebreaking office, known as Room 40, employed a strange mixture of linguists, classical scholars, and crossword addicts, capable of the most ingenious feats of code-breaking. The task of cracking this particular telegram fell to the Reverend William Montgomery and the former publisher Nigel de Grey. The telegram was encrypted using a code that they were already familiar with, and so they soon unraveled the outline of Zimmermann's plan. The chief of Room 40, Admiral Sir William Hall, considered showing the telegram to the Americans in order to persuade them to join the Allies. But then he had second thoughts. If the Americans entered the war because of the telegram, then the Germans would realize that their diplomatic code had been broken, and they might then upgrade their codes, depriving the British of valuable intelligence. Furthermore, unrestricted U-boat warfare was due to begin in just a matter of days, and this in itself might provoke the Americans into entering the war. Why risk losing a source of intelligence if the Americans might already be on the verge of joining the Allies? On the 1st of February, Germany embarked on its strategy of unrestricted naval warfare. But 2 days later, President Wilson announced to Congress that America would continue to remain neutral. This left Admiral Hall with no choice but to exploit the Zimmermann telegram. At the beginning of the year, Wilson had said that it would be a crime against civilization to lead his nation to war. But the Zimmermann telegram forced him to change his mind. "I advise that the Congress declare the recent course of the imperial government to be in fact nothing less than war against the government and people of the United States, and that it formally accept the status of belligerent which has thus been thrust upon it." A single breakthrough by Room 40's codebreakers had succeeded where 3 years of intensive diplomacy had failed. The security blunders of the First World War inspired post-war engineers to invent a mechanical form of encryption, something more sophisticated than paper and pencil, something that would re-establish secure communications. One of the first to meet the challenge was Arthur Scherbius, inventor of the infamous and complex Enigma machine. The Enigma operator would type a letter into the machine, which would send an electrical pulse through a series of wires so as to illuminate a letter on a lamp board. So typing in A might illuminate the letter G. However, after encrypting each letter, the wiring automatically changed, so typing A again would illuminate a different letter. In other words, the mode of encryption for every letter was continually changing. Furthermore, the changes depended on an initial setting chosen by the operator, and there are millions of billions of possible settings. With so many possible settings, and with the machine's internal wirings in constant flux, the Enigma seemed to offer Germany a distinct advantage at the outbreak of the Second World War. However, we now know that the British codebreakers at Bletchley Park broke the Enigma cipher, enabling Churchill to read the messages of the German Army, Navy and Luftwaffe, and to gain a clear advantage in the war. The cracking of the Enigma proves that complexity alone is no guarantee of security, and in fact, the most secure Second World War code was also one of the simplest. In 1942, Philip Johnston, an engineer based in Los Angeles, formulated a system of secret communication based entirely on his childhood experiences. The son of a Protestant missionary, Johnston had grown up on the Navajo reservations of Arizona and became fully immersed in Navajo culture. He learned to speak the language fluently, which allowed him to act as an interpreter for discussions between the Navajo and government agents. He became aware that the language was impenetrable to anybody outside the tribe, and then realized that it could act as an unbreakable code. If each battalion employed a pair of Native Americans as radio operators, secure communication could be guaranteed. Accompanied by two Navajos, he took his idea to Camp Elliott, just outside San Diego, and conducted a demonstration in front of senior Marine officers. The two Navajos were isolated from each other, and the first one was given six typical messages in English, which he translated into Navajo and transmitted to his colleague via a radio. The Navajo receiver translated the messages back into English, wrote them down, and handed them over to the officers, who compared them with the originals. The game of Navajo whispers was flawless. Johnston was given the go-ahead to recruit 29 Native Americans as part of a pilot project. The official report explained why the Navajo were the best tribe for the job. The Navajo is the only tribe in the United States that has not been infested with German students during the past 20 years. These Germans, studying the various tribal dialects under the guise of art students, anthropologists, etc., have undoubtedly attained a good working knowledge of all tribal dialects except Navajo. When America entered the Second World War, the Navajo lived in harsh conditions and were treated as inferior people. And yet the Tribal Council supported the war effort and issued a statement of loyalty, declaring that there exists no purer concentration of Americanism than among the first Americans. Within 4 months of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Navajo, some as young as 15, began an 8-week communications course with the Marine Corps. The Navajo code talkers, as they became known, soon encountered a serious problem. How could they translate military jargon into the Navajo language? To get around the problem, they constructed a formal lexicon of Navajo terms. For example, different types of plane were identified by the Navajo words for different types of birds. Fighter planes were labeled as hummingbirds, or dahetihi, and bombers were labeled as buzzards, or jesho. The lexicon eventually grew to over 500 words, but the code talkers would inevitably come across words that were neither in the lexicon nor had obvious translations into Navajo. This second problem was solved by constructing a Navajo phonetic alphabet. To transmit a name, such as Peter, the code talker would spell it out as pig, elk, turkey, elk, rabbit, which translates as Bisodich, Zech, Tongji, Zech, Gach. The code talkers had to memorize the phonetic alphabet and the entire lexicon so that there was no risk of a code book falling into enemy hands. For the Navajo, committing everything to memory was a trivial exercise because traditionally their language did not have a written script, and so they were used to memorizing their songs, prayers, folk stories, and family histories. On the 7th of August 1942, the US 1st Marine Division spearheaded an invasion of the Pacific island of Guadalcanal, taking with them the first group of Navajo code talkers to see action. They soon proved their worth in the battlefield. During one episode on the island of Saipan, a battalion of Marines took over positions previously held by Japanese soldiers. Suddenly, a salvo exploded nearby. They were under friendly fire from fellow Americans, who were unaware of their advance. The English-speaking operators sent a radio message explaining the situation, but the salvos continued because the attacking US troops were suspicious that the messages were Japanese impersonators trying to fool them. It was only when a Navajo message was sent that the attackers realized their mistake and halted the assault. A Navajo message could never be faked and could always be trusted. Their war of words soon turned the Navajo into heroes. Other soldiers would offer to carry their radios and rifles, and they were even given personal bodyguards, partly to protect them from their own comrades. On at least three occasions, code talkers were mistaken for Japanese soldiers and captured by fellow Americans. As the war in the Pacific intensified, the Navajo code talkers played an increasingly vital role. During the first days of the attack on Iwo Jima, more than 800 Navajo messages were sent, all without error. According to Major General Howard Connor, without the Navajos, the Marines would never have taken Iwo Jima. The contribution of the Navajo code talkers is all the more remarkable when you consider that in order to fulfill their duties, they often had to confront and defy their own deeply held spiritual fears. The Navajo believe that the spirits of the dead, Chindi, will seek revenge on the living unless ceremonial rites are performed on the body. The war in the Pacific was particularly bloody, with corpses strewn across the battlefields, and yet the code talkers summoned up the courage to carry on regardless of the Chindi that haunted them. One of the Navajo recounts an incident which typifies their bravery, dedication, and composure. In the wee hours, with no relief on our side or theirs, there was a dead standstill. It must have gotten so that this one Japanese couldn't take it anymore. He got up, screamed at the top of his voice and dashed over our trench, swinging a long samurai sword. I imagine he was shot from 25 to 40 times before he fell. There was a buddy with me in the trench, but that Japanese had cut him across the throat, clear through to the cords on the back of his neck. He was still gasping through his windpipe, and the sound of him trying to breathe was horrible. He died, of course. When the Jap struck, warm blood spattered all over my hand that was holding a microphone. I was calling in code for help. They tell me that in spite of what happened, every syllable of my message came through.